This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It was a short flight, but it wasn't intended to be that way. U.S. Airways Flight 1549 from LaGuardia to Charlotte struck birds on takeoff in New York, losing both engines. In the cockpit, Captain Sully Sullenberger relied on instinct and years of training and experience to make a life-saving decision, landing the plane in the Hudson River. That's a story most of us know, but one that Clint Eastwood has now turned into a movie. Sully opened last weekend to critical praise and big audiences with Tom Hanks in the title role.
Mayday, mayday, mayday. This is a Cactus 1549. Hit birds. We've lost thrust on both engines. We are turning back towards the LaGuardia.
Which engine did you lose?
Both engines.
Ignition. Thrust levers. Confirm. Idle.
Cactus 1549, if we can get a few, do you want to try to land runway 13?
We are unable. We may end up in the Hudson.
It's going to be left traffic, runway 31.
Unable.
Okay, what do you need to land?
No reload after 30 seconds, engine master 1 and 2, confirm off.
Too low,
off.
Terrain. Too low, terrain. Too low, terrain. Too low, terrain.
This is the captain. Brace for impact.
This movie does a wonderful job of capturing the drama of the miracle on the Hudson and provides us an opportunity to meet up with some of the Charlotte passengers who were among the 155 people on board who survived that flight on January 15th, 2009. They are sitting with me in front of the actual airplane recovered from the river and installed at the Carolinas Aviation Museum. We'll meet those passengers in a moment, but let's begin with Wally Coppinger, Executive Director of this museum from which we are broadcasting this hour. Good morning, and thank you for letting us be here today.
Good morning. Thanks for being here.
This is a remarkable place, and for those of you who have never seen it or would like to see it this morning, you can go to the WFAE Facebook page. We are broadcasting this program on Facebook Live right now. You know, I can't remember the last time I did a program in front of an Airbus. But here we are today, and for people who don't know this plane, the fateful Flight 1549, it's here in the museum. You conceived of the idea of bringing this plane here.
Yes, the idea of having the plane here actually started after they finished the investigation. The idea was the plane, nothing was on it was salvageable, so there was nothing they could do with the plane other than turn it into Coke cans, if you will, with the aluminum or whatever they would do to recycle it. So the idea was, you know, this is such an amazing story. This thing needs to be preserved. So word went out that they had decided that they would like to see a museum take this airplane. And the insurance company that had the claim on the plane started searching around, and they looked, and the Smithsonian was approached. They didn't have really room for an Airbus A320. The Intrepid Museum, which this landed very close to in front of up in New York, they're an aircraft carrier museum, and they decided that really didn't fit their mission. So we kind of got word that this was out there and that this plane had such a huge connection to Charlotte that it should come home to Charlotte.
Because the flight crew was based here. A lot of the
flight crew was based here. We had almost half of the passengers from Charlotte. The plane was bound for Charlotte.
Mm-hmm.
So the connection to Charlotte was so strong, it just seemed fitting that Flight 1549 finally came home.
I know that you have been around airplanes for most of your life. I know that you tried to fly, but your eyesight is like mine, not good.
Right.
So you couldn't qualify for that. So you have an affinity for airplanes, and you walked me around this aircraft before the show started. We'd still be walking around, but the show got in the way. You know everything about this flight and about this airplane.
Well, I know a lot. I won't say I know everything. I think some of the passengers here can tell you a whole lot more about it than I can, but we did a lot of intense research. We're a museum. We want to be factual. We want people to know the facts that as we found them through NTSB reports and through witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
We want to be able to share that accurately.
One of the things that the film points out, and the film is remarkably accurate because we're going to play later on that same sequence that we just heard with Tom Hanks. We're going to play it from the tower's point of view, the actual recording of the actual moment in time. It's verbatim, and it's almost exactly in the same time. in the sequence of events in the movie, after they lose both engines, the captain and the co-pilot are going through a checklist.
Correct.
On page 3 of the checklist, there is an instruction to do what?
To turn on the APU, which is
APU
the,
is what?
Auxiliary power unit.
And the reason I ask is because in the movie, they don't stop to define the APU, but they put it first. They don't wait till the third page. They put it first. Right. What did that do for that flight and for Captain Sullenberger?
Well, Captain Sullenberger, in his infinite wisdom as a pilot, and flying an Airbus aircraft, which is a what they call a fly-by-wire aircraft. So a fly-by-wire means that it's a computer-driven. So computer tells the flight surfaces what to do. He knew that if he lost power, if there was a chance he could lose the power to those computers, he needed to turn on his power unit. So he immediately states and he flips on the auxiliary power unit so that he can continue to have control of the aircraft.
And it makes you wonder why that's on page 3 of the manual.
Yeah. You'll have to ask Airbus about that.
This flight was also kind of fortunate in that this aircraft had capability, it had rafts at the exit doors, and normally these aircraft don't have that.
Right. This is an Airbus A320 EOW. EOW stands for extended overwater, which means that this type of aircraft is usually flown over large bodies of water. So it has life vests under the seats. You have extra large slides / rafts instead of just a normal slide. So it was. We believe that adds to the miracle that you all were on this type
because
of aircraft.
Because without those slides...
Well, you wouldn't have had the room that you have would have had in this airplane, so there could have been more people in the water, more hypothermia situations, and possibly some fatality.
Yeah. Why did this aircraft fly to Charlotte with all that extra water protection? Lake Norman? What's the deal?
Well, you know, every airplane flies over rivers and that type of thing. It just so happens that was the equipment they were using that day.
What happened to this airplane between the time it went down in the Hudson River and the time it was installed in this museum?
Well, they recovered it from the river, and then they took it over to a warehouse, if you will, in New Jersey, because they had to do a full investigation. Even though they knew that the geese were the reason that the engines went out and that the plane went down, they still had to do a full investigation of really every aspect of the flight. And so it sat in there for a couple of years, actually, after they completed the investigation. And then there was the... what are we going to do with it, type thing. And so that's when the determination was, as we spoke earlier, was, let's put it in a museum.
But the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, and others went through this aircraft with a fine-tooth comb.
Absolutely.
And they put markings on the plane that you pointed out to me. There are little circles here and there. And up in the front, some of those circles indicate where birds actually hit the fuselage.
That's correct.
How do they know that birds hit the fuselage in those points? How do they know that?
They did swabs on the aircraft, and so they did DNA testing, and so that's how they determined that's where those bird strikes were. So it was quite thorough. I mean, go down that far.
Except for the nose, which was damaged in recovery, which was not damaged by the birds or in the crash landing, and except for the tail of the plane, which was severely damaged in the landing of the plane on the Hudson, and the fact that the left engine was ripped from the wing on landing... The plane's intact.
Oh, I mean, it really looks incredible.
Is that a testimony to Captain Sullenberger?
Sullenberger, Airbus building this type of aircraft. I think a lot of things
because
would
you,
add up to
because
that.
You pointed out to me, this man, you have to remember that he had very little control over this airplane. There was no thrust. The engines were not working. It was a glider. And a heavy, heavy...
70-ton glider.
Heavy glider. So he had really no... Only control over the plane he had was on the flaps and what angle he could put the plane at. And you pointed out to me before we started that he brought the plane down at exactly 11 degrees. And there's a reason that that's important.
Yes. If there had been any different angle on that, if he would have been too tail-heavy, normally a pilot... to slow the aircraft down. He's going about 150 knots, so he would want to slow the aircraft.
What does that equate to in miles per hour? You don't know. Okay, that's all right. We can't know everything.
So he's going to raise that nose to try and slow the plane down so he's not going to hit the water that hard and that fast. And if he hits too tail heavy, the plane is going to just basically stop. The nose is going to go down in the water. The plane is going to break into pieces, into parts. If he does it too level, And the engines hit first, that's just going to dead stop it, and it's going to start doing a cartwheel across the water, and then, of course, it would be catastrophic, and the plane would break apart.
So, and he knew that, instinctively knew that.
He knew that.
Did they teach you that in pilot training?
Well,
you
know? I think, like, I know from speaking with pilots and everything, you've got to have this wisdom. They don't practice, and Captain Sternberg will tell you this, you know, they didn't practice this in the simulators of landing on the river, so you don't have a practice run at this. So he's just got to know through years of piloting aircraft, you know, what you got, what you have to do. Your experience played a huge role in that.
You've spoken to Captain Sullenberger, and one of the things you talked about, because he did fly again after this.
Yes.
He didn't retire and go to CBS News as
right. Not right away.
Not right away, but he did fly again. And you asked him what it was like for him to go back into the cockpit, the first flight he took after this occurrence.
Yes, as we spoke about that, I thought it was very interesting what he said, and I think it just goes to his professionalism. When he said that, we said, you know, what was it like? Were you anxious to get back in the plane? He said, yes, that's what he loved to do. He loved to fly, and he was very anxious to get back in the cockpit and fly and do what he did for a living. And the one thing that he said, what I thought was amazing, was when he sat down in the seat and he put his seatbelt on, he felt like he was wrapping the plane around him. And so I think he literally is one of those types of pilots that just really becomes a part of the airplane.
And you know, most of us see aircraft like this from the window of the terminal before we board. We don't really see the airplane as we get on it because we take that little tunnel into the first class compartment and drool over the drinks that they're having in first class as we head back toward the edge of coach. One of the things that struck me when I walked in here, and even though this is not a 747, which is much, much bigger than this, this is a big airplane. The tail of this plane is enormous. And, in fact, you had to take the right engine off the plane because you haven't got enough height in this building to have the engine clear the floor.
Well, the engines were removed prior to us. Well, the one had come off, and they retrieved it from the bottom of the river. The other one was taken off during the investigation because they had to break it down and study it and see the damage done by the bird ingestion. But literally, when putting the engines back together, we would have never been able to remount them on the plane because our hangar here is the height of the ceiling is not high enough.
Right.
So it is. And like you say, we walked down a jetway and get on an aircraft, we don't stand beside a plane and realize how massive they actually are. We just get that perspective of walking down the aisle of the plane and getting in our seats.
So when people come into this museum and they look at this, you can literally almost touch it. You don't want them
but please
to touch
don't.
It. Please
yes.
don't. Yeah, because it's an artifact. It's an historical artifact
Absolutely.
Like any other museum
Absolutely.
Piece. What's their reaction?
I think when they first see it, a lot of people will just kind of stop. And a question a lot of people ask, because I think it's so unbelievable, is that the actual airplane? And, of course, we're like, well, yes, of course it is. But I think it's just so unbelievable that this plane, in the condition it's in, to think about what it went through, flooding in the river, hitting, I mean, it's unbelievable. So it's almost like this, wow, I just can't believe this. It's just mind-boggling for a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, the Coppinger knows everything about this plane and about this flight. We'll talk some more to him about this as we go through the program. He's the executive director of the Carolinas Aviation Museum, where Flight 1549, the actual aircraft, is now housed. When we come back, we will meet three of the passengers. Two of them were actually seatmates on the flight, and they're seatmates this morning, aisle and center seat. We'll meet them in just a moment as Charlotte Talks continues from the Carolinas Aviation Museum.
Good morning, it's Charlotte Talks at 90.7 WFAE, funded by our members and Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting Breaking Convention, the International Festival of Hip-Hop Dance Theater, September 30th and October 1st, featuring shows at Night Theater and family-friendly activities at Levine Center and Spirit Square. Tickets available at 704-372-1000. And Hobart Financial Group, Inc., striving to create a custom financial blueprint that carries less risk, provides growth opportunity, serving Charlotte for over 10 years. Details at askhobart.com. While the NCAA pulls its championship games from North Carolina, Wells Fargo reacts to fines over bogus accounts created to meet sales goals, and county commissioners react to North Tryon redevelopment plans. That's all in the local news roundup when Charlotte Talks tomorrow morning at 9 on WFAE and WFAE.org.
On the next Diane Reams Show, new data show the biggest uptick in median household income in decades and a steep decline in the U.S. poverty rate. What's behind the good news for middle and lower income families and implications for economic policy?
Hope you can stay tuned for that. The Diane Reams Show starts at 10 o'clock right after Charlotte Talks at 90.7 WFAE.
No one warned us. No one said you were going to lose both engines at a lower altitude than any jet in history. This was dual engine loss at 2,800 feet, followed by an immediate water landing with 155 souls on board. No one has ever trained for an incident like that.
That's Tom Hanks from the film Sully, ruminating on what it was like to land this plane on the Hudson River. And in fact, those are words that he said during the testimony to the NTSB. We're sitting here on WFAE and Facebook Live on WFAE's Facebook page, talking to three passengers in just a moment from Flight 1549, and also Wally Coppinger, who is executive director of the Carolinas Aviation Museum. The last question I asked Mr. Coppinger before the break was, what are people's reactions when they visit this museum and see this airplane? And I really want to hear from the passengers about their reaction when they first came back here to see this airplane. Beth McHugh joined us on this program shortly after Flight 1549 landed. I want to say crashed, but it didn't crash. It landed in the Hudson. She was seated in row 30, seat C, on the aisle, close to the rear of the plane, and was coming home to Charlotte after working in New York and New Jersey all week. Good to see you again. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mike. It's good to be back.
Eileen Schleffer and Vic Warnament were seatmates. Eileen was 13D, Vic was in 13E, and they are seatmates today. And once again, Vic is the center seat, as he was on the airplane. hope don't get too cramped, and there are no babies on this flight. No crying babies. Thank you for joining us as well. What was your reaction when you came and saw this? Is it something that you wanted to see again, or did you only come back because you knew it was going to be a big gala event and all the passengers and crew were invited and Sully was going to be here, and okay, well, I'll come too? What was your reaction about having to come here in the first time, and when you actually came, what was the reaction? Beth, I'll start with you.
My reaction was one like a lot of the other passengers. When we walked in the door at first and saw the giant aircraft sitting in the middle of the museum floor, it did not have its wings yet. The wings were reattached later.
Mm-hmm.
But the sight of it was pretty stunning. It was not the first time I had seen it when it was on its momentous journey down from New Jersey on the giant truck bed. I actually drove up a couple of hours north where they parked it for the night at one of the trooper stations along the highway. And I just wanted to get close to it and look at it.
Vic?
And it was emotional.
It was emotional for me as well. The reverence with which the plane has been treated, the passengers have been treated by both the airlines, our families and communities, really is awe-inspiring. And it leads to, I think, a deep sense of reflection. For me, coming here was the first time I saw it again in person, although it had been tied up in New York right behind my office before it was moved to the warehouse. And so my friends brought lots of pictures. They could not bring my luggage, but they did bring pictures. And my family was really insistent upon being very engaged with this event, as much for them as I think for many of us as passengers.
Eileen.
I saw the plane come in on the highway when it moved into Charlotte, and I wanted to see that very much to prepare myself to see it here when I knew I'd be by myself and I could sort of process how I felt about it. And I was amazed at how intact it was, and the, which is, I think, a tribute to how they're built, how the Airbus is put together with all that it went through. And I think it looked like it was in better shape than I felt. But it was emotional.
The inside of this aircraft is not available to see by the public, but I'm told that the passengers have been allowed. Did you all decide to go in? And you, yes. What is it like in there?
It's in a little bit of an upset condition, but it's actually remarkably in good shape. The seats where some of us took our seat cushions with us are missing seat cushions, of course. There are a couple of the overhead doors that are still open as they were on impact. And the rest of it is a little dark, as you would expect, but most of the things that you see inside are just like they were, except for the hole in the floor.
You mentioned, Vic, how nicely you and the other passengers were treated by the airline. I've always wondered about this. This is a stupid question. Can I ask a stupid question? Did they refund your fare?
They did. They did two things ultimately for the passengers during the course of the process. They at one point issued a $5,000 check to each passenger.
Whoa.
In order to pay for computers, estimated value of goods, you know, incidental expenses you may have had in any travel back, and so on. After the NTSB investigation concluded, and it said it was an accident involving Canadian geese and so on, and the story you've told, they offered, in full settlement of any potential claims, an additional $15,000 to each person. As I recall, only two passengers during the whole course of this event tried to rally passengers to consider a lawsuit against the airline of some type. And having been a practicing lawyer, I scratched my head about what did they do wrong? Accidents do happen. And I think many passengers sort of responded in emails, mm-hmm. saying, we're in this together. This was an accident. Please don't proceed, and I will not participate.
I was also surprised to find that you know, you have to leave an aircraft quickly, and so you leave your belongings in the overhead bins, and, of course, the cargo bay was full of luggage. Many passengers got the contents of their belongings back, dry cleaned and wrapped in paper. Really?
Yeah.
Were you among them?
Tissue paper. Many things that I never would have suspected we would get back. There were only three things that they told us they couldn't return, which was anything liquid, which meant that great bottle of red wine I had bought out on Long Island was gone. They couldn't send back medications, and they couldn't send back anything that was completely, totally destroyed.
What has this experience done to you and your willingness to get on another airplane? Eileen, I know that you are not a flyer by nature. You never liked to fly. You said you've always been a nervous flyer, always book an aisle seat and count the rows between you and the exit door, which is a very smart thing to do. Have you been back on an airplane since then?
I was on an airplane the very next morning.
Well, of course.
And then I continued to travel for work and for, you know, vacations and personal time.
Do you feel differently about getting on airplanes now? Are you more cautious, less cautious, more optimistic, less so?
I continue to be a very nervous flyer. I still go through the very same routine that I did then. So it didn't make me any less concerned.
You were the, I'm told, you were the only person to scream. When did you scream? What elicited that scream?
I believe it was a reflex, a startle reflex when on the impact. I mean, the impact was, and the noise, the boom, when the bird slammed into the plane, really, I think because perhaps I'm so acutely aware of everything because I'm nervous, I know all the sounds of, you know, when the wheels go up and all of those things. I'm kind of aware of all those things. And when it hit, it was, to me, a boom. And the plane stopped and shuddered. It just, it was shuddering. And I thought it was a huge impact. And I screamed.
Take me through it. Take us through it. What were your experiences? The first sign of any problem, obviously, was the thud when the birds hit the engine and the fuselage. Then what was it like? What did it feel like? What did it sound like? What were the sensations that you were going through as passengers who were completely in the dark about what had happened?
I'll start. All noise went away. And so if you think about your usual travel, even if you think it's a quiet plane, it's still quite noisy compared to sitting in near silence, except hearing people whispering and talking. And the loss of thrust was also an interesting feeling. As you climb on an airplane, you always feel yourself pushed back against the seat to some degree until it really tops out and begins to cruise. And suddenly it was, as I've told people, it's like sitting on a very hard kitchen chair or a bar stool, and there's no thrust anywhere. You're just sitting still, processing and observing what other people are saying as you begin to really think this could end badly, or we are probably going, you know, to go somewhere. And
you felt that? That thought went through your mind right away?
Absolutely.
Because the plane is climbing, and suddenly it's not climbing.
Correct. And as soon as we had the impact, within a few seconds, you felt very briefly, or at least I sensed, the effort to turn the plane. So you, at least I did, think, we're going back to LaGuardia. But it's a flight path I've taken hundreds of times in my career. And, you know, you suddenly realize, well, that's not happening because we are not turning. And I knew we would lose, for me, when a plane turns, it loses altitude if it doesn't add thrust. And I knew that from being around private pilots for a long time. And so then it really dawned on me, we have a serious problem. I hope there's some way we limp to Newark or Teterboro. And then it became pretty clear. It was a very clear day for flying, and you could see a long way, and you really realized there's no way we're making it that far either. Now, what we would do, West Side Highway or Hudson River, started to become a topic that I could hear whispered in the plane.
Anybody who knows the West Side Highway, I guess, would know that landing a plane on the West Side Highway would be probably catastrophic, don't you think?
I think it would be for many. Better than trying to land on any other street in New York, though.
Yes, absolutely.
One of the things that happened initially was that rancid smell that permeated the cabin. I mean, it happened very quickly. You could smell burning fuel, flesh, all of that. And, you know, no one knew what it was, but it, you know, clearly it was the birds. But that smell was throughout the cabin almost immediately. And there were people who had seen flames from the engines who started yelling fire. The combination of that, of not recovering, of stopping the climb and trying to turn, and the smell and people yelling fire makes you think, this is bad.
Beth, you were in seat 13.
20.
20, excuse me. And you did see the engines. You knew the engines were gone.
I could not see them exactly. I was on an aisle seat, but the young man who was sitting by the window... Mm-hmm. When I looked over at him as if questioning him, tell me what you see out there, he looked back at me with this almost imperceptible shake of his head, and I looked in his eyes, and he went like this, and I could tell it was so bad. And then I knew later that the engines had been on fire, and that's what he could see.
You have said that at one point you knew you were going to die.
Yes, I was sure that we were going to die.
Can you explain to us what that feels like?
It was a pretty stunning feeling, actually, and it took me probably a full minute of our 5.5 minutes in the air to process that what's going to happen. I was thinking of my daughters, of my grandchildren, thinking my daughters will handle this well with my grandchildren, but what is my family going to do? It's going to be so hard for them. And once I got past thinking that, I thought, okay, I can't do anything about this. This is something I have to accept as something that's going to happen. I can't do anything about it. Let me just accept it. And once I got my mind wrapped around accepting it, I felt this sense of calm that, okay, we can do this. We're all going to be in a spot we never expected to be today, but we can do this. And
Dick?
I just accepted it.
What was it like for you?
I didn't know whether we would die. It's clear it's a possibility if you're going to crash or...
You're an optimist, aren't you?
I tend to be, but I thought it was very possible. I also thought it may not happen, and what would you do? But nevertheless, I think I went through some of the things that people speak about in near-death experiences where images of my family, particularly when my kids were young, or things with my parents being concerned about my family as well, flashed through my mind.
You know, the captain yells, brace for impact. I don't think anybody who's not... I would wager that none of us in this room have ever heard a captain get on the intercom and say, brace for impact. You felt panic, nauseating panic, Eileen, at that point. But then you say you felt a sense of peace sweep over you that you've never felt before or since.
Right. I think what Beth said about kind of wrapping your head around it, that this wasn't going to end well, and the panic set in, the terror of it all sent that prickly feeling, that nausea through my whole body, and I thought, okay, this won't end well. I need to call my husband and tell him goodbye. So I did that. And
yes, you spent almost the entire trip down on the phone with your husband.
I did. I know. Well, we were going to crash anyway, so I figured it wasn't good.
What has he told you about his end of that conversation?
Oh, poor guy. Well, first of all, I had just spoken with him when I had gotten to the airport because I was late and almost, missed it. But told him I was boarded and seated and everything was okay. See you later. And then I called him from the flight, and he didn't expect the call, of course, and he answered by saying, hey, what's up? Are you going to be late? And and I started this whole conversation about, oh, my God, something hit us, and we're going to crash, and he's like, whoa, wait a minute. And, he thought I was overreacting to turbulence or something. And that, so he said, what are they telling you? What are they telling you? Usually the captain comes on and says, okay, keep your seatbelts fastened. We're hitting some turbulence, something like that. Nothing. I mean, and it was silent. And I said, it's eerily quiet. And I don't know. They haven't said anything. So he... the call dropped a couple of times. We had a couple of conversations, but I left him in a panic.
We had to shorten that because we have to take a break. We're coming to you live from the Charlotte Aviation Museum. We're talking to three of the passengers on Flight 1549, the Miracle on the Hudson. And when we come back, we'll talk about the landing and getting out of the plane.
At Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins, live from the Carolinas Aviation Museum on 90.7 WFAE, your source for in-depth news. Support comes from our members and UNC Charlotte Botanical Gardens 50th Anniversary Symposium on Saturday, October 8th, featuring Amy Stewart, author of The Drunken Botanist, along with lunch and a garden tour. Registration at gardens.uncc.edu. And SunTrust Bank, providing tools and information to help people take a step toward financial confidence. SunTrust Bank, member FDIC. Well, coming up on the Diane Rehm Show, middle class income is up and the poverty rate is down. We'll look at what the new data could mean for American families and economic policy. A. Martinez, in for Diane Rehm this morning. That starts at 10 o'clock, right here at 90.7 WFAE.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
This is the second North Korean nuclear test just this year alone. NPR's Elise Hu is in Seoul. And
it's your community. We help you understand it.
The fight over North Carolina's election overhaul is the kind of legal debate that can drive strangers to fill a city street together.
When I say what you want, you...
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're broadcasting today from the Carolinas Aviation Museum on WFAE and on WFAE's Facebook page on Facebook Live. You can see the broadcast that way. We're sitting in front of Flight 1549, the Airbus that has become known as the Miracle on the Hudson, talking to three of the passengers, Beth McHugh from seat 20C, Eileen Schleffer from seat 13D, Vic Warnament, seat 13E on that January day, and Wally Coppinger, who is the executive director of the Carolinas Aviation Museum. When you see the movie Sully, which is why we're having this conversation, because Sully opened last weekend to pretty damn good reviews and also to big audiences, it's brought this topic back to light. When you watch that movie, which I'm told by all reports is a really good recreation of what happened, it is quite apparent that Captain Sullenberger is in total control, not only of the airplane, but of himself in a life or death situation. Very focused on everything in the plane and outside of the plane. And we played a clip from the movie at the very start of the show where they're going through that sequence of trying to figure out what to do. Here's the actual conversation between the tower and the cockpit.
Cactus 1539, hit birds, we've lost thrust on both engines, returning back towards LaGuardia.
Okay, you need to return to LaGuardia. Turn left, heading up 220.
220.
Tower, stop your departure, he's got emergency returning.
Who is it?
It's 1529, bird strike, he lost all engines, he lost the thrust in the engines, he's returning immediately.
Cactus 1529, which engines?
He lost thrust in both engines, he said.
Got it.
Cactus 1529, we can get it for you. Do you want to try to land 1313?
We're unable. We may end up in the Hudson.
Joining 2760, turn left 070.
070, joining 2760.
All right, Cactus 1549, it's going to be left traffic to runway 31.
Unable.
Okay, what do you need to land? Cactus 1549, runway 4 is available if you want to make left traffic to runway 4.
What's over to our right? Anything in New Jersey, maybe Teterboro?
Okay, yeah, off your right side is Teterboro Airport. Do you want to try to go to Teterboro?
Yes.
Teterboro, Empire, actually LaGuardia departure guy, emergency inbound.
Hey, go ahead.
Cactus 1529 over the George Washington Bridge wants to go to the airport right now.
Wants to go to our airport. Check. Does he need assistance?
Yes. It was a bird strike. Can I get him in for runway 1?
Runway 1, that's good.
Cactus 1529, turn right 280. You can land runway 1 at Teterboro.
We can't do it.
Okay, which runway would you like at Teterboro?
We're going to be in the Hudson.
I'm sorry. Say again, Cactus.
One of the things that strikes me as you listen to that conversation is his incredible calmness, the captain's incredible calmness and control, but also the fact that they keep calling this airplane by different flight numbers. 1529, 1539, 1549. What's the meaning of Cactus?
Okay, Cactus, that's a good question. Every airline has a call sign and a call name, and U.S. Airways came originally from U.S. Air out in or America West Airlines out in Arizona, and so their call sign was Cactus.
Okay.
And so that's how I got this. So when they merged with America West, when U.S. Air merged with America West, they kept the call sign of America West, which was Cactus.
Now, during this entire time, he's talking to his co-pilot, he's talking to the tower, he's not talking to you.
Correct.
The only thing I think that Sullenberger said to the passengers was, this is the captain speaking, brace for impact. What went through your head?
Well, then I knew I was right. It wasn't going to end well. But at that point, I said to my husband, and he heard it, that the captain had come on, and you know, I said, I have to go, and I said my goodbyes, which was the hardest part, and And that's when I accepted my fate, and that sense of peace came over me. But then also, I still had hope. You know, there's always that little bit of hope that you have. He sounded so calm and collected that it really, I think, gave me more hope. And
but you're flying over Manhattan and yes. Brooklyn and places like that, which is heavily populated. There's not a square inch without a building on it. You knew, Vic, that you weren't going back to LaGuardia. You probably weren't going to make it to Teterboro. So what did you think you were going to impact when he said brace for impact?
At that moment, by looking out the windows, you knew you were going into the Hudson River.
You did know by that
because
time.
The buildings were far enough to your left, the Palisades of New Jersey off to the right, and you knew you were going in the river.
So what does it feel like? How does it feel different from landing normally and landing on a river?
Well, Eileen shared her seat space with me because I don't fit between the seats very well when I fold over for brace. Eileen chose to stay up with her arms on the armrest, which later caused a large injury for her. People started to duck at different paces, and I ducked late, so I saw that. And it was a very, very hard landing.
You knew, probably before these two people knew, that you were in the water because you were in the water. The water started coming in from the back of the airplane first.
Yes, that's
Describe
true.
That experience.
As soon as we hit, and it was a very rough impact, it was very strong, and in the back of the plane, which is where most of the force of the landing was, because of that 11-degree angle and because of the tail hitting first, apparently this large 15-foot hole that you can see in the fuselage when you walk around the plane here, that was torn on impact. I did not even get to pull my head up from that brace position to start to unbuckle my seatbelt, and I could feel the water rising up around my feet. That's how I knew I was still alive, the water was freezing cold.
I was going to say, January in the Hudson in New York City.
Yes.
And one of the things, one of the only comedic lines in the film was the co-pilot was asked if he could do it again, what would he do differently? He said, I'd do it in July.
Yeah, so would we. Believe me, so would we.
Talk about getting out, because getting out of an airplane under normal circumstances takes forever. It took no time for you people to get out of this airplane, and yet there were problems getting out. Talk about that experience. You helped subdue panic, as I understand it, Vic.
I did. A gentleman behind me started, because of the smell and people calling fire, he was screaming, just get out, in very graphic terms, and began to push forward, which pushed me onto her back and another person who kind of, I think, knelt down. And so I had to turn around and kind of push back very firmly. And as I did that, like I saw and can reflect on so many passengers helping others. Very few people really lost control of themselves. Mm-hmm. Some did. And for every person that did that, there was someone there to help. And so hands went up on this gentleman's shoulders and said, I've got you. We're going to do this together.
Wow.
But it was still, you know, one of the things in the movie that isn't portrayed in the interest of time, and it's Sullenberger's perspective about his experience primarily, is how pressurized that environment was to get out. We had people in the back calling water, water, water. Getting out onto the wings is more difficult than you think. The doors look big when you sit next to them. They're quite small when you have to get out. And the wing is not at the cabin floor level. So you're twisting your way out the door, and you know you have to get out to help others. And we were immediately on the right wing, stepping into water.
And slippery.
And it's slippery. And we had a number of passengers slip off the wing and into the water. And people, as they swam back or held their ground against the current and the plane drifted to them, would pluck them back up onto the wing without as much effort as one might think it would normally take.
Beth, you said you have never been that cold in your life.
Right. And never want to be again.
Because you're sitting, I would imagine you've taken off your winter clothes, your coat, and you're sitting in the cabin like this.
And my shoes came off when the water came in. I had a pair of those Crocs on, and they just floated away in the water as soon as The water washed them off my feet when I struggled to stand up in this now knee-deep water. They came off my feet, so I had on a shirt and slacks and nothing else.
Did the two of you, Eileen and Vic, did you go out the window exit? Is that how you did it, or did you go out one of the slides?
She broke left onto the wing. I broke right.
And what about you, Beth?
When I got up to the wings from the back of the plane, there was no more room. People were straddling the exit row windows, attempting to get out onto the wings. The flight attendants up front were calling, come forward to the life raft. So I came all the way up to the front of the plane. And it actually was appealing to me to go to the front because I could see up there. I thought, there's no water up there. And so I could walk forward with my seat cushion and go all the way up. And I jumped out into the left life raft, which was the life raft that Captain Sullenberger and First Officer Skiles came out into afterwards, too, when they finally evacuated.
How many people took their seats and used them as flotation devices or got those little yellow things that you blow into and blow up? How many people took those with them when they left the airplane?
Hardly anyone.
Why?
I don't think, well, when everyone yelled, water, water, it didn't occur to me that we were in the river. And so perhaps those people who were, you know, closer to the windows could
tell flight attendants didn't?
No. Well, you know, if you're in the middle of the plane, there were two flight attendants in first class and one in the back.
Right.
And that was a long way back.
She was injured.
So, yes, she was injured.
Badly and didn't know.
Badly.
A piece of metal came up through the floor.
Yes.
And into her leg.
A terrible injury.
Yeah.
Right.
Mike, I would just like to add, Eileen, I didn't take my safety equipment either, like most people. Only a few people attempted to get their things out of the overhead bins, and the group think said, just leave it, let's go. But you've just hit the water going 150 miles an hour, crushed open the back of the plane. So you think about that impact. There was the second impact, which I think for many was maybe more impactful, was when the engines then laid down into the water and it stopped the forward momentum of the plane. So you are thrust forward.
Right.
People talk about their bruised hips from the seat belts, your head smashed into seat trays and on. And now you have people yelling, fire, get out, everything else. So in that moment, people were very calm about what they had to do, but their minds are racing so fast that I think you forget. And we've all heard the warnings and safety instructions on planes so long. Most of us probably listen better than the average passenger even today. You know, it just kind of goes through you, and you didn't have time to prepare
right.
for it. We didn't come down from 15,000 or more feet.
You find yourself outside the airplane. The water is freezing. The air is freezing. You're on an aircraft that is clearly sinking. And off in the distance, there are boats coming to you, but I'm sure many of you were not aware of the boats trying to come to you. How long did it seem? It didn't take long for them to get to you and get you on board, but how long did it seem?
It seemed to me, someone asked me later on, how long did it take, and I thought it was more like 25 minutes or so, and then I found out that from the time we left the ground at LaGuardia at 3:26, we hit the ground hit the water 5.5 minutes later, basically 5.5 minutes later. I would never have thought that. I realized later that your brain expands things in a traumatic situation just to allow you to cope with the stress of the data coming into it.
But on the wings, Mike, passengers did see the ferry boats coming. And so for many of us who are familiar with the ferry boat traffic of crossing the river, people could declare to everybody, they're coming.
Mm.
And I think that helped people digest that there was real hope.
We only have a few minutes left, and we just did a show on trauma and post-traumatic growth a couple of days ago. And people who go through traumatic events report that their life changes. How have your lives changed, Beth?
I tend to appreciate everything more. I hug everybody now, and that's one of the things that I do that makes me feel good and makes them feel good, and people tell me that.
Vic?
For me, it's live in the moment, and a philosophy I've adopted a long time ago, but I was deeply reminded of it, and that is God and faith is first. My family and friends are second. and I am third. And I have a duty to give back to all of them, to my community, and to share, you know, the good fortune that I have to be here and the time I can spend with all of them.
Eileen, a frightened flyer, a member of the Belk Six. There's six people from Belk on that plane.
Right.
How has it changed your life?
I think I'm just more aware of how much kindness matters in our daily lives. I was really traumatized for a long time, and the kindness, the simple acts of genuine kindness that started with the first responders and continued with cards and calls and visits from people who I hadn't seen in years that were so direct and so genuine impacted me really dramatically. And I'm really aware of that every day now.
And one of the things that comes across in the movie and that people from New York have talked about is that the movie plays New Yorkers, portrays New Yorkers as incredibly giving and caring. And that comes, it's very emotional when you see them helping the passengers get back to life. This is called The Miracle on the Hudson. Is that what it is?
Definitely. It is truly a miracle. And, you know, I am so grateful. I am so grateful we had Sully. I'm so grateful. There were a number of miracles. The water was calm. The ferries were in place because it was rush hour. And
I'm going to stop you there because we're out of time. Eileen Schleffer, Vic Warnament, Beth McHugh, all passengers on Flight 50.